Well, yes, this is Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the Great Southwest, and once again, you are listening to Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind. Wolves by Lois McNeice. I do not want to be reflective anymore, envying and despising unreflective things, finding pathos and dogs and undeveloped handwriting and young girls doing their hair and all the castles of sand flushed by the children's bedtime level with the shore. The tide comes in and goes out again. I do not want to be always stressing either its flux or its permanence. I do not want to be a tragic or philosophic chorus, but to keep my eye only on the nearer future. And after that, let the sea flow over us. Come then, all of you, come closer, form a circle, join hands, and make believe that joined hands will keep away the wolves of water who howl along our coast. And be it assumed that no one hears them among the talk and laughter. Well, yes, here we are again. Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind. What shall we do today? Well, today, I am weary of the pertinent, the relevant, the arena of music and ideas fraught with meaning. Let's take a break. Let me tell you a story about a couple of old friends. It was Bob and Doy DeWitt. They may even be listening to this somewhere. They live at Red Mountain Ranch up there in Mariposa, California, up in the Sierra. Why, Bob and Doy lived down in Topanga at the time that Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and Ramblin' Jack Elliott and Lord Buckley used to play at his place called the Feedback Theater. I guess Bob hasn't worn shoes, but maybe three or four times in the past 25 years. They're both of advancing years. I was up visiting them. I was going to play there in that house, way up in the woods. And I changed the strings on my guitar. And when I got them changed and finally had a tune, I started to play. Well, Bob was at his desk drawing with his drawing pencils. He's a fine artist. Doy was chopping vegetables. They eat pretty much what they grow. As soon as I started to play, Bob put down the pencils, and Doy put down the cutting knife, and they flowed together in the middle of the room and began to dance, to twirl, to minuet, to do a random series of motions that were incredibly graceful. Now, with the music that we're going to play today, I want you to try to do the same thing. Stop what you're doing wherever you are, except when you're driving, and launch yourself into a terpsichorean flight. And let's dance, and let's have fun. I remember at the toy store down in what around here we call the Nut Tree, seeing an old man at the counter, a salesman, very old man, and I saw his business card on the counter. It said, Horatio Q. Birdwhistle. Well, I said, are you really Horatio Q. Birdwhistle? He said, you know who I am? I said, darn right. You used to be with Spike Jones and the City Slickers. Turned out he was one of the last two surviving members of that organization. He did all the bird sounds and a couple of other unspeakable things that I won't mention. I first heard Spike Jones and the City Slickers on the stage of the Hippodrome Theater in Cleveland, Ohio. My stepfather managed it at that time. And my brother and I made the popcorn. My mother took care of the concession stand. It was an enormous old place. But what a joy to see the City Slickers and Spike Jones with all of their stuff spread out. I mean, gongs and whistles and guns and bombs and junk to fall on the floor. I mean, they did, and the musical cues were so precise that it was almost impossible to figure out how much rehearsal time must have gone into making that happen. Well, there was a big theater organ there in the Hippodrome, but it never worked. It hadn't worked for years. So Let's open up with the biggest Wurlitzer organ ever built for the Radio City Music Hall, recorded many years ago, and then drop it right into Spike Jones.
Secluded rendezvous that overlooks the avenue with someone sharing a delight. Chat, this and that, and cocktails for two as we enjoy a cigarette to some exquisite chansonette. Two hands are sure to slyly meet beneath a serviette with cocktails for two. My head may go really, but my heart will be obedient with intoxicating kisses for the principal ingredient. Most any afternoon at 5, we'll be so glad we're both alive. Then maybe fortune will complete the plan that all began with cocktails for two.
Well, those of you who have television sets now, of course, I shot mine about 18 years ago, and I'm a better man for it. But there are videos of Spike Jones available in action. There's a Spike Jones fan club run by his son out of Long Beach, California. File that away. That's good information, especially when the holiday season's upon us and you really want to surprise somebody. I did forget to mention that not only am I here, but Steve Baker, the engineer, is here, twisting the knobs and pushing the slides. This is KVMR. The studios of KVMR are a hometown community radio station, the last of the steam-powered community radio stations here in delightful metropolitan Nevada City, California, the town which boasts the inventor of seedless corn. Let's go to Russia. Huh? Richard Chews, a friend of ours here, said, Russia, where they now have crime, prostitution, economic chaos. For 70 years, we tried to get them into the international community. We finally succeeded. We're going to listen to an old friend that I made playing at the Vancouver Folk Festival and other places around Canada, a virtuoso on the three-string ukulele, which in Russian translates into balalaika. Alexander Ilyich Epler. Now this requires you dancers there a vigorous kazatsky. This is Play My Bagpipe. Alexander Ilyich Epler on the balalaika. Isn't that wonderful music? I hope that your bodies are now glazed with sweat as you've hurled yourself about your premises. Oddly enough, a tune called Play My Bagpipe. Ah, the bagpipe. An old friend of mine who lives in Vermont, Rick Polieri, plays Polish music. His family were all Polish. He did something extraordinary, Rick. Did school tours, grade school tours, in a rented van to rural schools all over the northern Great Plains state in the dead of winter when school's in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska. And he told me a story about doing that, and I turned that into this story that I'm about to share with you. And then we'll go right into Rick Polieri playing the Polish bagpipes. Jamestown, North Dakota, midwinter. Cold, the volunteer firemen lean into gale force winds and with hatchets chop the dogs loose from the fire hydrants. A near whiteout, and the end of the world seems imminent. The small cafe, wreathed in swirling clouds of snow, emits a feeble though welcoming light. The last, lost diner teetering on the edge of the great American nowhere. Inside, a handful of snowbound rustics, leavened with a few extremely tardy truckers, revel in the warmth, the camaraderie, the sprightly, light-hearted banter common to such places and occasions. The coffee urn breathes a comforting gurgle, and the moist air is redolent of lutefisk and pork rinds. Suddenly the door is flung open, the small bell attached to the jamb jangling with a pathetic urgency, and into this Rockwellian tableau stumbles Rick Polieri, clad in full Polish regalia and cradling under one arm what for all the world looks like a small pig with several wooden legs. A moment of stunned silence until one large rustic, a natural leader among men, thrusts out a well-horned paw and barks, "Howdy, stranger. New in town?" "I'm Rick Polieri, a Polish bagpiper," Rick replies, "and I just played at a school one town over. I was on my way to the next school when I saw the light and decided to stop in for breakfast. Didn't have time to change out of my costume." Placated by this plausible explanation, delivered in such a matter-of-fact manner, the rustics invite Rick to a repast with the assembly, and he soon establishes an easy rapport by rhapsodizing over the restorative virtues of highly petrolated cuisine. The check arrives. "It is the custom of my people," Rick intones, "after such a splendid meal, to play a song for the cook." He raises his porcine bundle, puts mouth to leg, and blows. The bundle, which proves to be a bagpipe, emits a series of sounds which, while perhaps not heavenly, are certainly unearthly. As the last notes trickle away into an unbelieving silence, the cook raises the check and reduces it to shreds, which he launches upward as if to say, "Well, don't that beat all?" Rick gathers the bagpipe, now tamed, under his arm, tosses off a cheery farewell, and exits, leaving behind an atmosphere charged with awe and wonder. Outside, he makes his snow-blind way to his rented van, where his dog, Kozak, Polish for bagpipe, greets him with a yelp not unlike those recently delivered by his namesake. Rick mounts to the driver's seat, wakens the machine, and like some ancient Wagnerian hero, plunges into the withering blast. To this day, the people of Jamestown recall with whimsical disbelief the visit on a cold winter's day of that spectral vision, and parents, despairing of getting their children to bed, threaten them with a raucous concert from the one now known as the Phantom Pole.
Ukavola kuchmorovano, ukavola kuchmorovano, kuchnichka, a za kuchnyasko vlichkim zuzichka, kuchnichka, a za kuchnyasko vlichkim zuzichka, ho!
Oh, yes, Rick Pollieri, a really good friend. Well, now, the bagpipe, a sort of a universal instrument known to the ancient Egyptians. I was on my way hitchhiking to Oban on the west coast of Scotland to play at a little place called McTavish's Kitchens. I was hitchhiking, you know, hitchhiking in Britain, about 200 miles to get there, and of course, to the people I was staying with, I guess it was in Nottingham, a trip like that is board the dog, cancel the milk, turn off the gas, lock the place up. A real journey. Well, of course, if you've hitchhiked in the West, you know, in Utah or Wyoming, you know, 200 miles is ain't even half a day's work. I set out to hitchhike there. Slept overnight at Glen Coe, where the McDonald's were all destroyed. They said you couldn't sleep outdoors there because it was haunted, but I did. Whereas the McDonald's of Glen Coe were wiped out. I won't even say their names, but I sure as hell don't eat their damn soup. Well, I made my way to McTavish's Kitchens, where the show I did was destroyed by the crew of a minesweeper in from Belfast who were determined to get as drunk as they possibly could. Caught the boat over to Mull, took the bus across Mull, then a small boat over to Iona. You see, my name is Bruce Duncan Phillips, Utah's the AKA. My grandmother named me after Robert the Bruce and King Duncan. I had been looking for Duncans while I was in Scotland, and one old man over in Perth said, "Well, you've got to go to Iona, the burial place of the kings of Scotland." The abbot of the little ruined church there took me out into an overgrown graveyard. It was an enormous oblong red granite stone, and he pointed at it and said, "There, under that, is King Duncan, the first of your line." He left me. I sat on the stone. I watched the seabirds wheel overhead, heard the whistle on the small boat that it was leaving, so I stood up and took my wobbly button, my union button in the industrial workers of the world, and thrust it far under that red stone for the benefit of future archaeologists. And then I went back to Oban. The great pipes, the Peb Moor, the classical music of Scotland is the Pebroch, from the Isle of Skye, the Macrimmon country. Nobody knows where this music comes from. It's incredibly ancient. Let's listen to a bit of John Burgess, the great pipes playing the beginning of Lament for Duncan Macrae of Kintail. Well, of course, after what's called the 45, the great pipes were outlawed, and the tunes had to be transferred orally. I have some recordings of the Pebroch being chanted, being sung. Of course, the pipes were then made legal when the English needed the Scottish levies to build their damned empire, and that's when the military tradition invaded the great pipes. The Pebroch, though, is Celtic meditation music. They last for sometimes longer than 20 minutes. You seek it out and see if you don't see what I mean. The small pipes come from Northumbria. Instead of blowing into a bag, you have a bellows under one arm and you wag your elbow and work the bellows, which is strapped around your middle, and it's piped into a little chanter with about three drones, and then a little other set of keys called regulators that add another overtone or with which you can change keys. To me, one of the greatest proponents of the Julian small pipes, the Northumbrian type pipes, is Alistair Anderson, whom I met when he was traveling with Johnny Handel and the high-level ranters from Newcastle-on-Tyne. They were touring the United States, playing all the small clubs, sleeping on the floors like everybody else. I remember it particularly because Johnny Handel had been a coal miner up there and by Newcastle. And he knew this peculiar style of grappling, which purported to be a wrestling style, and he insisted on teaching me how it was done after their show in Saratoga Springs, New York, at a bar called the Tin and Lint down on Caroline Street. Wow. He threw me about quite a bit. We smashed up quite a lot of furniture and were finally asked to leave. There's other parts of this story that I'll get to later on in the year. In any case, that's how I got to know Alistair Anderson as a member of the High Level Ranters. Let's listen to Alistair playing the small pipes with a bit of Gillian the Drover and the Hisleyside Reel. Well, you've heard the pipes now, different kinds of them. I love pocket instruments, things that you can carry around with you and take out and play whenever you want to. People don't generally think of Abraham Lincoln as an instrumentalist, but Abraham Lincoln did play the Jew's harp, or as we call it in Utah, the Gentile harp. Ah, but Abraham Lincoln also had a rose tattoo. I bet you didn't know that. The best proponent that I know of the Jew's harp, the jaw harp, up here in North America is a fellow from Bellingham, Washington, by the name of Larry Hanks. Larry's an old friend and a song finder. You ever looking for a song that you can't find? You get a hold of Larry Hanks in Bellingham, Washington, and he probably knows it or it can steer you in the right direction. Let's listen to Larry Hanks and Laura Smith on the frail banjo doing Sourwood Mountain. Mexican polka he learned from a schoolmate when he was a little kid, I think back in 1937, he said. I've mentioned Tom Scribner down in Santa Cruz any number of times, the old wobbly, the old communist who played the musical saw on the streets. There's a whole musical saw festival that's held every year down there in honor of Tom Scribner. By the way, if you wonder why I'm doing this, you know, the mandate of public and community radio is to bring you things that you can't get on commercial radio that you might need, and I honestly believe that you need the Jew's harp, that you need the bagpipe, that you need the balalaika. You may have a different opinion, but that's my opinion. Now, here's the musical saw. I remember the first festival they held when Tom was still alive. There were 50 saw players on the stage playing Let Me Call You Sweetheart in 12-part harmony. It was absolutely stunning. There was even a little guy, an old man with a tube, with a tank-style vacuum cleaner, and he'd hold the tube up between his legs with it on, and he would stretch a rubber band over the mouth of it and play songs. I'd go a long way to see something like that. Tom, like I say, was a radical. He was a red. But he was he spoke that worker's shorthand that cuts through all of the lard real fast. No matter what the political polemic was, he would cut through it with the comment, "Where's the pork chops?" Let's listen to Tom Scribner and Arlene Serenaders once again playing Melancholy Baby on the musical saw. Remember, this skate is ladies' choice. All skate in the same direction, please. Tom Scribner and his musical saw. You got to make sure that that's facing the right way when you put the bow on it, too. I've seen it done the other way, and it doesn't work awful well. Now, instruments that you can carry with you, instruments that are eminently portable. There was a fellow at that same musical saw festival, fine saw player, by the name of Roy Thorson. And he was a large band, beautifully figured, and bright, bright blonde hair. I knew him to be instantly of Viking blood, although when the affair was over, I didn't find anything missing. Besides playing the saw, Roy Thorson was a concert whistler. And also a brakeman for the Canadian Pacific up in Calgary, Canada. Let's listen to a bit of Roy Thorson, a concert whistler, the whistling brakeman, singing or whistling The Rising of the Lark. Thank you. Well, when's the last time you heard something like that? Wouldn't you like to work on that railroad with Roy Thorson whistling at night when you're coupling the boxcars? Well, now, our local newspaper here, once again, it's the Union. It's an interesting paper. It prints a lot of worthwhile information. I picked it up yesterday afternoon when it was hurled up into my driveway, neatly wrapped up in cellophane with a rubber band around it, because it's been raining here where I live since New Year's. There was an obituary in there for the man who planted the bushes a bird in the hand is worth two of in. But in the sidebar, in the entertainment column, it announced that I was going to play for the local listeners here a record of the longest and highest yodel note ever recorded. As I say, a promise made is a debt unpaid, and the trail has its own stern code. But first, the yodel. I was in Switzerland, over in Apfenzell. I was doing a festival many years ago called the Gürten Festival. I went out in search of the yodel. The yodel was invented at Apfenzell, the canton, as a way to signal from ridge to ridge as they moved the cattle from the winter pasture to the high Alpen meadows. Alps are not mountains, you know, they're meadows. I was taken to old inns made out of wood, made out of mud and wattle. And in there, the elderly Alpen gentlemen would sit and quaff beer out of enormous steins made out of a cow's horn set in chased silver stands. And they would sing slow, elegant yodel choruses. I looked at one of those horns, several of them, and I saw there weren't any cattle around me that I had seen that had horns that large. But then I remembered Caesar's conquest of Gaul and how he talked about the aurochs bull that had never been tamed and was absolutely enormous. And I looked at those giant horns, and it occurred to me finally where I was and what I was listening to. So we're going to listen to the Alpen horn, those great horns that stretch down the mountainside, a field recording with the bells and the shouts that move the cattle up to the Alpen meadows, and then into one of those taverns to hear a bit of an Alpen chorus, and then crossing the Atlantic through vaudeville, through Jimmy Rogers, to Elton Britt in the early 1950s, and the longest and highest yodel note ever recorded, Chime Bells.
Mockingbird singing, yellow-o-dee. Sleep, my little lover, yellow-o-dee. up on a summer's eve. Oh-da-da-dee-oh, out on the mountain so happy and free, there lives a maid, she's waiting for me. Out on the lake we'll drift with the tide and hear those chime bells ring. Chime bells are ringing, po-yellow-dee, mockingbird singing, yellow-o-dee. Sleep my little lover, yellow-o-dee, up on a summer's eve. O-da-dee-dee-oh-da-dee-oh-da-dee-oh-da-dee-oh-da-dee. Moonbeams were shining as I kissed her there. Nightbirds were singing, perfume filled the air. Each little star just twinkled with glee while heaven smiled on me. Chime bells are ringing, ho-yellow-dee. Mockingbird singing, yellow-o-dee. Sleep, my little lover, yellow-o-dee. Up on a summer's eve.
I said I'd do it, and I did it. Now, you know, Slim Whitman, three times tried to do it that high and that long, and three times he failed. Elton Britt is no longer with us. Alas, he got the hemorrhagic fever, something like yellow jaundice, while entertaining the troops over in Korea. That's where I became first familiar with his music. What a great yodeler. Well, sounds. That's what we've been doing this hour, is different kinds of sounds that you might not be accustomed to on your commercial radio and on most of the music that's being recorded today. The sounds and the stories. Woody Guthrie talked about the common speech of the people being the greatest sound, the lilt of the language, the uncommon and or common phrase that has that peculiar meter that resonates in the mind and out comes a song. Woody felt, as I do, that nothing happens inside your head without something happens outside of it first. And it could be anything. It could be the sound of a railroad train, of a whistle at night. It could be the sound of a well digger, or the sound of the wind in the willows along the river's bank. There's a fellow that used to record for the progressive movement many, many years ago during the 1940s, early 1950s, by the name of Ernie Lieberman. Wrote songs for people's songs. Let's listen to Ernie Lieberman sing The Song of My Hands.
This is a song about working hands. A lover sings of his own true love. A sailor sings of the sea, and what can I be singing of but of my only property? I'll sing a song of my hands. Hear the call of the midnight train echoing down in the mine, the hiss of the steel and the grind of the crane and the rumble of the assembly line. That is the song of my hands. I'll tell you why of my hands I sing. The kids at home eat what my hands can bring. When towers of steel rose from barren plains, did you see my hands working there? around us, the tractors, the trucks, and the cranes. We laid stone upon stone upon stone in the air. And on top of the job were my hands. My hands are for sale. What will you give? What will you pay that my family may live? What is the value of my two hands? Appraise them as you've done before. They built your factories, tilled your lands. They made you riches and they'll make more. What will you pay for my hands? My two hands, they're my take-home pay. They're how much milk at my door. And how many pounds may my children weigh? How will you figure the price before you tell me the price of my hands? Calculate carefully. Ponder it well.
Going up, step to the rear of the car, please. Second floor, ladies' bargain counter. Third floor, children's department, toys and games. Cafeteria, tea room. Fifth floor, complaint department.
Beautiful day for the race. Stooge Hand is the favorite today. Assault is in there. Dog Biscuit is 3-1. Safety Pin has been scratched. And at 20-1, Beetle Bomb. Now the horses are approaching the starting gate, and there they go! And it's Stooge Hand going to the front. Cabbage is second on the rail. Beautiful Linda is third by a length. And Beetle Bomb. Around the first turn, Stooge Hand is still in front. Cabbage is second by a head.
Cabbage by a head!
Beautiful Linda is third. And Beetle Bomb. Into the back stretch, Dog Biscuit is now leading the pack. Lady Evelyn is second, very close. Banana is coming up through the bunch.
Banana coming up through the bunch!
And Beetle Bomb. At the half, Stooge Hand still out in front. Apartment House is second with plenty of room. Assault is passing Battery.
Assault Battery!
Notary Sojak is fourth. And in last place by 10 lengths, I believe it is. Yes, it is Beetle Bomb. around a turn, heading for home. It's Stooge Hand and Dog Biscuit and Girdle in the stretch. Flying Sylvester is third, and Mother-in-Law nagging in the rear.
Oh, oh, oh!
And now they come down to the wire, and it's number one, and now number two, and it's very close. It'll either be a photo finish or an oil painting. And now Lewis leads with a left, and Lewis is in there slugging, and it's a battle, and now they're tearing hair. There's hair all over the ring. There's hair all over the place. I don't know whose hair it is. It's mine. And there goes the winner.
There you have it, back where we started with Spike Jonze and the City Slickers. That was Doodles Weaver doing the calling of the races, an old friend of the family. Every time Spike Jonze and the City Slickers played in Salt Lake at the old Capitol Theater, which my father booked, Doodles Weaver would stay over at our house. I've enjoyed sharing all of these sounds with you, you know, and I look forward to doing a whole pile of irrelevant things in the future. Here's a song recorded in 1946 on the island of Fiji. We sometimes forget that the recording business was going on all over the world and not just in North America and in Europe. 1946. The Japanese had been driven out of Fiji. The Second World War was over. The U.S. occupation troops were pulling out. As they wend their way down toward the ships to climb up the gangplanks to leave, the school children from the girls' school at Sewanee gathered on tops of the silent, empty concrete bunkers and serenaded them as they sailed away, never to return. And this is what they were singing, Isolei. Well, thank you. Thank you for your kindness, charity, and patience. I require abundant quantities of both. This has been Loafer's Glory, Hobo Jungle of the Mind, a psychic landfill. I look forward to being with you again next week. Tap it light. From Rabindranath Tagore, 1916. With too much thinking, my hair has gone gray. With too much reading, mine eyes have grown dim. I have wasted my life piling up heaps of the fragments of things. Jump on them, dance on them, scatter them all to the winds. For it is the height of wisdom to be drunk and go to the dogs.